You're Alan Adams. Okay, this is Alan Adams and Mr. Dahlman are here. And we're going to hear the true story or the story from the Adams point of view. We're going to... Okay. Okay, let's hear it.
Mr. Matthews was an agronomist from the University of Wisconsin. And he was deeply concerned about the fact that the animals with the dust in the grain, they got the sniffles, and the oat hulls and all pierced their intestines and so on. He felt there was a better way of doing this. He also felt that there was a way of building into a unified food for these animals, something that had alfalfa, maybe a little bit of dried milk, of various kinds of grains. So he developed this concept of the vertical hopper onto a wagon wheel hub and the female and the male
stain
cone. Yeah, all right. And he applied energy to turning the hub of the wheel on the axle with the, in due course, with these grooves. And this produced a flake. And alfalfa, as we all know, has a lot of qualities that we all need, vitamin-wise and otherwise. And these produced flakes. And the flakes were then fed to animals. And they didn't have the sniffles, they didn't have the pierced intestines, they didn't have all these problems. So Mr. Matthews felt that he had an original concept of what could be better. So he went to Mr. Clarence Webke.
Must have been a local tool and die maker.
No.
Okay, what do you want, Dan?
Mary.
What? Do you want my story or do you want to...
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So he went to Mr.
Schwebke.
Clarence Webke. You had a tool shop, a machine shop in South Lake. And Schwebke was a client of my father's. And Schwebke was smart enough to realize that we have to have an engineer, we have to have money, we have to have management. So he went to my father's law office and asked to have first a patent applied for. Second, and my father pointed out that we need money, we need engineering. My father was a great friend of the late Earl Berry, who was the chief engineer for the Polite Corporation. And so between the, by this time they formed a corporation, applied for patents and so on. And this business about my father getting 25% of stock is a bunch of carp at this point. But they did employ him to be the manager of this thing, because neither one of these two gentlemen, Mr. Matthews or Mr. Schwepke, he had any managerial abilities. I am a partner in the law office this time, and my mother and myself, and we don't feel that this manager responsibilities for my father would be the best for the law business. But he could see that this was an opportunity that should be explored. This is a new concept of how you feed the world, you know? Meanwhile, they take these flakes and they feed them to rabbits and they multiply and they rabbits are very fecund in any event, and they were bigger and they were more numerous in their litters, and they took these flakes over to the farms at Lake Delavan, who then owned the hotel in Chicago, Stevens Brothers Farm. And all of these animals, they didn't have these problems with their intestines or with their snuffles, and they survived and so on. As a matter of fact, I took in the first dollar for Flake All Corporation, which is they called it Flake All because of Flake All. And Mr. Matthews decided that, that he's going to be a millionaire overnight, and this is no more power to him than perhaps could have been. But they were flaking this, and so finally my father got Mr. Berry to do this, and father put money in this thing. He had a management contract. And then a gentleman from Darien, whose name was, you know this, Ronald.
Yeah, but I forgot.
Well, he and several others, and Marge Bartel's father and her brother got involved in developing this machine up to the point where Mr. Berry took over and made it something. And so the concept was that they would make animal feed. And they started making animal feed, and Mr. Clarence Wepkis down in South Polite, one time, they cleaned the machine out with cornmeal or cracked corn. At one time, this spiral, thing came out in a sort of a collar form, a puffed corn. And when it fell on the cold concrete of that plant down there, it broke into pieces. And somebody elected to call these collets. And collette is the French word for a small collar. So then Ed Wilson came along. Ed Wilson was a graduate of the Annapolis, and he was at that time a lieutenant commander, so he'd come home for the summer to be with his family here, and his family, one of the professors at Blake College. And
Taylor Merrill.
Yeah. Taylor Merrill's wife was his sister, as I recall. And so Commander Wilson saw these things that were in little collets, and he took some home and he fried them. And he passed them around, he fried them, and he put salt on them, and pepper, and gave them to his neighbors. And then somebody else suggested that maybe we should put cheese on these things. Meanwhile, I'm feeding these things to, selling these things, number one, selling these flaked alfalfa things to the rabbit growers, because in the Depression, rabbit meat was a heck of a lot cheaper than anything else. And I guess I probably lost the original dollar I took in. So when Mr. Wilson did this, and they called them corn kernels, then the people who were, pardon the reference, but the basic people, whether it be Claire Matthews or the man from Darien or Marge Bartel's father, all these people, Frank or whatever his name was, decided we're going to get in the business of making these things, which they did. And then they gave them, this became a very popular thing, and people from all over the country came in to get these things, and these characters, Flake Hall Corporation, a separate corporation, you were one of the directors, Ronald.
There was a Stacy company, wasn't there?
I guess Stacy for the moment. But they began allotting to themselves, the shareholders, territories for making what these things are called as corn kernels. And the unfortunate thing is that they sold the collets to themselves at a price which could not permit Flake Hall Corporation to survive. So they came back to my father and said, I think we need management here, which he provided. I guess the desires of myself as a law partner and my mother and all the rest of these things, you could see how much time and controversy, and how I like to say this, but how uneducated, businesslike some of these people were. And so meanwhile, they're making these corn kernels and they're selling them off, but the Flake Hall Corporation going down the drain because they can't make enough money, and somebody had to take home. So meanwhile, one of their customers was the Elmer Candy Company of New Orleans, and they made what was known as Cheewees, Cheewes, you remember this, right? And they were much better merchants than these local people were. So they began putting these things in tins that would be different from putting them in bags. Now at this point, bags were cellophane, or not cellophane, they were glassine bags. And the shelf life of a product like this is extremely important. And these characters they couldn't do much else because the shelf life of the glassine wasn't too good, but they spread the stuff out and the company's losing money. So one time, Arthur and I went down to New Orleans to meet with the Elmers. And they had a contract whereby they could sell anything in tins or other containers for any price over 15 cents. And Arthur and I decided that this is no way to run this thing. So help me. So we bought out their rights to sell this product in containers excess other than tins.
Bought out whose rights?
The Elmer Candy Company. These guys had given the Elmer Candy Company an exclusive all over the country to sell in tins and any containers over 15 cents. Meanwhile, these products, shelf life is a big, important thing, and tins are important. But we bought out, and I went to Art and I, we went, I think it was something like $90,000 a piece in debt to buy up their rights. And we had in mind that as the, I'm a small, poor lawyer. But we had confidence in this thing. Meanwhile, my father said, well, Vernon, he's not investing in this. This is not his discredit, but he's running the Flakeall Corporation. So along about this time, Mr. Bartelt, or Marge Bartelt Brown, through a licensee of Claire Matthews and these other people who owned the stock, had made contracts of Mr. Oscar out in Portland, Oregon. Remember that. We wanted to terminate his contract. He was paying less than the cost of the product and so on. So we took the bull by the horns, Father, Arthur, and I, and terminated his contract. Then the lawyer for this, Mr. Oscar, was the president of the Oregon State Bar Association. And he came out to the meeting, and he had meanwhile gotten a hold of Marge Bartelt, and this is in Lodge, to sue us for $3.5 million. Because they claimed you were a college rival, but father, I think, had a salary of $30,000, and I, as secretary, had maybe $2,500, and Arthur had something else. We're all contributing our time and effort to this thing. Meanwhile, the stock of Flakeall, the first thing we did was to raise the price of the Colettes from a price that was too low to support the vitality and the viability of Flakeall Corporation to something that was reasonable. Instead of the stock paying no dividends, all of a sudden it's paying $94, $95 a year dividends. You remember that. It was paying nothing. You had the stock.
Oh,
it
ran for 20 years without any dividend.
So Marge Bartelt Brown, Sid Brown's wife, threw this Mr. Oscar in Oregon, sued us for $3 million, the biggest civil suit they'd had in Rock Valley ever. And to make a long story short, a lot of laborious thing. We finally settled the thing, get rid of it for $5,000 just to get rid of the litigious nature of this. Meanwhile, Arthur and I figured that we should have an Adams Corporation, and we would buy Colettes from Flakeall Corporation at instead of paying 6 cents, we'd pay 9 or 12 cents instead of 9, wherever the fee is, where I want to call. But a substantial amount above what Ms. Stillman and Jerry Ann and these other people were paying. Meanwhile, Clarence Schwabke, was lured away by people in other areas. I won't go to the names of the Frito-Lays and all the rest of them. Because he felt he wasn't being paid enough. He hadn't bought any stock. And so yeah, it became so complicated. We had all kinds of litigious problems. The validity of the patents and all of these things that interfered with the main direction of the company. So anyway, Arthur and I, we supplied the money, and he borrowed money, and I borrowed money, started Adams Corporation. And through little old Elmer Lutie, you remember Elmer?
Oh, yeah.
We built a building up there, even though there were priorities. You couldn't build buildings. Elmer had some sort of a connection to build the buildings. Meanwhile, they made me president of Adams Corporation. I was president, I think, because if the thing went down the drain, I'd be the least publicized failure, if you follow. So I became the president of Adams Corporation. We built this thing, we had this big shebang. Meanwhile, one day from New York, this is the time of 1946. Art and I were up to our ears in debt with the Elmer. And we're counting on the come of these other companies to these other license agreements that they had made to terminate that these gentlemen from Darien, and I won't remember the names, would terminate, and we would take them over, which we did. But we still had to buy out the Elmer Candy Company with reference to certain price to merchandise. So here's Herman Lay of the HWLA, Frito-Lay company, coming up wanting a license, and the Frito people coming up wanting a license. And the Doolin brothers who formed the Frito company, one of them had a long fingernail and long heels and high heels, and I won't go into all of that. But they said, in essence, they felt the patents had some validity rather than have a failure in this thing or have a litigation. But they would like to have a license. This began the license process. It's getting so complex, I don't know where to start now. But we got this Adams Corporation going, and we took over gradually these other licensees that these people had started. Meanwhile, Marsh Brown is suing us for all of this, and we got rid of that litigation. Then the gentleman from whom we were buying our bags, the company from whom we were buying our bags, was a batard, and he wrote the patent office, and he got copies of the patent, and he started in business in Chicago, and he waited. He had great distribution for his business, because he had news in Southern Carmichael. So then we had to sue him, and his sales manager refused to testify for him because this gentleman was telling all these lies about how he got in the business. And that fellow's name is Bill Happel, the late Bill Happel. And Bill Happel then came to my father and said, I think we ought to start our own bag company. But I'll have none of this. So we started our own bag company, which is National Cellophane Chicago. Meanwhile, a fellow by the name of Carl DeWeese, who was working for the cheese company, the Kraft Cheese Company, and who had originated Kraft cheese, I can't tell you what the name is offhand, for the cheese popcorn, you may recall it, Ronald, a very good trade name for cheese. He had a factory in Chicago, this Carl DeWeese, which he, among other things, had this cheese mix for spraying on products, which is a very delicate thing, because if you have moisture, you know, with milk and cheese, it molds. But he had a process for that. He also has some soybeans that he calls salty size, and he claimed they'd be very masculine if he ate less of them. And his factory burned down, and my father, Harry, decided one day that Carl Lewis, this guy's a genius, and I'd like to set him up in business. I'm digressing, but this is
That's all part of it, yeah.
It's all a part of the very broad story. So, against Arthur and my recommendations, Harry furnished money to Mr. DeWeese, and this became the Del Food Cheese Company. And the Del Food Cheese Company sold cheese to Adams Corporation. Meanwhile, we had this National Cellophane Company, but along came, and we were buying all of our cellophane. This is beyond the time of the previous film which I mentioned, which was less impervious to Martian than cellophane. And Uncle Sam came along and said, you have a contract with DuPont to buy cellophane, and you have control of your company, and you can't buy cellophane from DuPont because this is monopoly. Meanwhile, we're having another lawsuit because Uncle Sam came in and said, you can't control prices without a patent. And we have patents, but patents under the federal laws, they're good only in the jurisdiction of the particular district. You might have a judge in this district, the Western District of Wisconsin, say your patent is valid. But a Northern Illinois district would say it's invalid, and that there's a conflict, and the only place you can go is the U.S. Supreme Court. And at that time, one of the justices of the U.S. Supreme Court, I've forgotten his name, it's a well-known Democrat name, said that the only valid patents are the patents that haven't come before our court. I could go on and on. So anyway, trying to shorten the story, Adams Corporation did so well because these products were so. The potato chippers were local, loci people, and they couldn't afford to deliver their potato chips without something else. They were selling needles and threads and all of these things, and noodles and all the rest of them, and the field people. We had these little trucks that go around, but they couldn't make a living that way. So when this product came along, which was a natural, they were delighted to take it on to carry part of their problem. Well, we held up trains in the Southwest Limited from Milwaukee to Kansas City for an hour or so, and they loaded this stuff on to go to Southwest. So anyway, Adams Corporation went along real well, and we had lots of people going to business in competition with us because we couldn't, because of these other contracts, these local people who thought they were going to be millionaires overnight, and St. Clair Matthews woman sold stock. This is how the Bartels got into it. He sold stock to the Bartels for some nominal sum, and sold stock all over the place. We had to keep buying up this stock.
Well, like yours.
Well, all right, same idea.
Dad's stock, he got it from Clear.
Yeah, well, we had to somehow get control so we could run the thing.
Sure. Yeah, that's what Dad was telling me, that you had to get,
No way, these guys are, everybody's greedy, but these guys are super greedy. Yeah. Plus, not business people.
Well, all of the Dad and Ron had done was just subsidize Clear through the whole business, through all the years, let him live freely.
Yeah, and exactly, your husband and the Goodwin family, who were, they're busy making milk and cream and all this stuff and raising dairy cows,
and
not sure whether with all of this rhubarb going on over here, how it's going to wind up. And Ronald used to come to the board meetings.
I know.
And I think sometimes with reluctance, he'd say he'd vote with the majority, but he was always supportive of our family, trying to get this thing started out.
This is all very, of course, it's not that accurate, but it's condensed. But it said, I had Daddy now enjoys going to stockholders' meetings in order to nominate Harry Adams for president or whatever.
Well,
because he was supporting you guys.
He was concerned about all of these things going in these different directions. And So I mentioned this Archibald at one time, during 1946 or 7, when the red points were the red points are still on cheese and milk and all of the butter and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't make corn kernels, even though we had this, Art and I had this big obligation to the Elmer Candy Company, we couldn't make corn kernels with cheese on them. And in California, they were making it without cheese and doing a good job, just a little butter and salt and pepper. But the main thing had been developed was the dehydrated cheese. So one day this fellow calls up from New York, and this is Matthew Archibald, who calls up. He says, I'm the chief pilot of Pan American Airways from the United States to South America to Europe and back, and this and that and the other. And I've just been the Azores, or the Azores, if you prefer. And I've seen this can of chiwis from the Elmer Candy Company. I've traced this out, and I think that this all goes back to Flakeball Corporation in South Philadelphia, 09. And I think you're making a big mistake by not making a big thing of this. And I'd like to buy a piece of the action. And he's talking to me on the phone. I said, I'm going to the law. So I said, hey, nice to know you, Charles. Well, we can't get any cheese. We have no way getting any cheese. No red points. We can't get oil. They don't have any red points or oil. Well, I said, perish the thought. No problem. He said, you know, my best friend's divorced his wife, and I married her, and she's a Morro of the Morro Nut Houses. And we got oil coming out of our ears. We also have cheese coming out of it. You've seen the Morro Nut Houses in Chicago and Toronto and Montreal and Milan, you know what I'm saying. And we can give you all the oil and all the cheese you want, and I'll be off on tomorrow morning. He said, I'm flying tonight to Chicago. I'll be out tomorrow morning, 11:15 train, Northwestern, and the depot or the depot in Beloit. And I'll have a can of chiwis in my hand. You can recognize me. All these people get off the train, and I don't want to buy any company. I said, forget it. We're not interested in that. So anyway, I went over there. I'm sure it was Archie, and he wanted to put money in this thing. He could furnish the oil and the cheese points without violating the law. And to make a long story short, he did buy it in the company. And then he said, I'm tired of flying these airlines. I fly these flying boats, and I've had fires, and I've had dissident people, and I don't want any more of it. And I married my best friend's wife because he mistreated her. And I'd like to move into the hinterland. But I've looked around. I'd like to move to Lake Delavan. And I'd like to buy a piece of the action. Well, we needed money. We needed points and all this. Dark night. We needed money to pay our bills. So Archie bought into the company. And he became the sales manager. And he was meanwhile, we built this new plant on Harvey Street. And Humphrey Foster, he led the bone and they were all in the state. That a great time.
When did you have time for your law practice?
Well, we didn't. That's what I'm trying to say. Arthur had time for the bank, but I didn't have too much time for the law practice, and neither did Father, actually. I shouldn't mean Arthur, but mean that. The bank is a different deal. You've got to be there every day. And lawyers can sometimes delay things, but bankers can't. And Archie came. He became the sales manager, one of our. But he had itchy feet. You can't sit still too long. If you've been traveling, flying, and been the captain of an aircraft, we had a plant at that time. My father established a plant in Hawaii, and then along came. A strike from Mr. Bridges. They had a corporation out there. We were sending the pullets out there to fry them and make them into something and ship them to Japan and Southeast Asia. So in 1950, this Bridges strike became such that you couldn't import things over to Hawaii. So Archibald and I went out there. Terminate this thing or move it one way or another. About 2 weeks before that, I had bad kidney stones while I was in the hospital for about a week. And the local doctor told me...
Okay, this is continuing the saga.
Local doctor told me this is the living you love to take. But Alan, if you have problems, if you bleed excessively now in this train out to the West Coast, come and say we've got doctors in Denver and Winnipeg and all over the place, and you just can get off the train and get a hot tub, this will be fine. Well, Archie and I arrived in Portland and got up to Seattle and took off on this plane, a Pan American plane, to Hawaii. At that time, it was the longest chartered overseas non-stop flight in the world, from Seattle to Honolulu. And we took off in a rainstorm, and Archie said to me, he said, well, I'm a pilot of Pan Am. This is a double-decker of Boeing Stratocasters. This guy, Lisa Blanco, I know this man, he's retired. And he can't have these mortars on his lung without some fire or something. Anyway, we finally got from the clouds. But he and I went down along with some other people into the lower deck where they had the bar. Just short of the point of no return, and lightning and all sorts of things going on. And I can't drink because I've had this problem with urinary tract. Archie's in the way back to the pilot. So all of a sudden we smell smoke, and bells ring, and two big lightnings coming down, and the plane starts coming around the circle, and comes down on the pitch. Giving you too much detail.
Oh, this is a terrific story.
Yeah,
go on.
The bridges comes down the stairway again. And he rushes in. He goes by the bar. And he rushes into the forward compartment to keep the luggage. He's gone for a couple of minutes. He comes back and he's sniffing. He actually went up the stairs. Meanwhile, bells are ringing. So then the captain comes down and he goes. He rushes into this compartment. He goes back and he says, pardon me, but we have a circular place we sit down there. And Archibald, this time being a Panamanian crowd, he's turned green because he's firing a plane. He's serious. And the captain says, who is smoking your ass? You remember in those days?
Yeah.
To be nonchalant and smoking your ass. He said, who's smoking murads? And would you please stand up and see if there's one of these murads down among the cushions? Of course there isn't. Well, all short and necessary, but by this time we've gone beyond the plane motor turn. And two of the motors are out. This is a 17-hour flight. As the light begins to come up and then the water gets closer and these things are out, you can't have any breakfast or no power. And you see these army planes out here along the side.
Escorting you because they know you're in trouble?
Trouble. Well, at least you'll be left. But,
what was the trouble?
Well, the trouble is a fire in two motors.
Uh-huh.
And they had these carbon dioxide things. They put the fire out somewhere along the line. It reminds me of an old story. Turn this thing off. Maybe I remember this old story. Turn this off.
Is it one that can't be heard?
Well, no, it's clean. About the Polish brothers. Remember?
Let's hear it.
Been on a flight before?
No, let's hear it.
And they're taking this flight from Poland to somewhere in the western United States. And gosh, they're in the air and many hours out of her voice person. Plane shudders a little bit as they do in the motors, as one of the motor stops. And the captain comes on and says, catch, he says, you know, we've lost a motor on the upward star motor, upward starboard motor, and we're going to be delayed 15 minutes to our destination. So the plane is going on, and then there's more lightning, and then there's another shutter, and the captain says, have you heard this? I don't want to report it again. We've lost another motor, and we're going to be delayed maybe 40 minutes to arrive at the destination. And these two brothers are confusing about this. I think this is a time is not different. England maybe for years or two. So then there's the final shutter, and we cross the captain's address and say, we've lost the larboard inboard motor, and we have an indefinite delay in arriving at our destination. And for one pole says to the other, he says, you know, Father, this is the first thing we know, we're going to be up here all night. Anyway, we finally arrived at Honolulu, and the very long story short was this thing was a desperate situation. And we finally terminated this and closed the factory. But meanwhile, other things were going on in the United States, and I come back to the main thrust of the thing. We prevailed in the patent suit, and that company went out of business, and then they moved to Canada, and then they began to air assist from Canada. And then the question was whether we should have licensees, or whether we shouldn't have licensees, or whether we should have our own distribution, and distribution was a large basic thing. Meanwhile, we'd licensed PLA people and various others. And I had gone to Europe and had licensed the largest food company in Germany, even the largest food company in Europe. So then come 1956, Father died, and Arthur and I had these things still going.
Yes,
he did. And I'm convinced of this. But meanwhile, lots of things had happened. People who couldn't get a license from us because of these original contracts. We couldn't get the contract by agreement with other people. We couldn't license. People had taken some territory, so they were taken by others. And then we were moving along very well, by and large, without any distribution of our own. And along came the fire that we had in 59, I think it was, and one morning we called up and said, your plant's on fire, and we were there, these are serious up in flames. And we had tentatively been courted by a number of companies to sell off the company, which we really didn't want to do, but the tax problem didn't go on in rent. So all of a sudden you have accounts receivable, and you need an inventory that's bigger than you can afford to have, and you still owe money, and you need new machinery and all of this stuff, and if you die, you have no liquidity, you know. So I communicated with our senators and our elections groups on these tax problems, are this enormous. We're going to have to sell a business. We can't stay in business. Because if one of us dies, the tax will be so enormous, you can't pay off the debt. If you don't pay in those days, you didn't pay in 6 months, why, you had a 12% penalty or something. Fellow of the American Probate Council, and so on, and so about that. So, after the fire, we had, about the time of the fire, we had been courted by a number of people, and one of them was the Beatrice Company, and they were interested because we had, by this time, operations abroad. And Beatrice only had one operation abroad, and that was an interest in the dairy in Kuala Lumpur. So, put the story again. We had Consolidated Foods on the bias. We had a very fine opportunity to sell the Consolidated Group Foods, Flake All, Dell Foods, and Adams, but they wanted to kick out all of the people. We wouldn't have Larry Tyson or Terry or anybody else. They wanted to put their own people in. So again, to share the story, Bill Carnes was then president and CEO of Beatrice, a real sharp, wonderful old shoe guy like your dad and yourself. said, Alan, he said, I think you ought to sell to us, and if you'll give up your law business and start this international thing, which we'll start Adams International, be the head of Adams International. You can be my personal representative. In Asia, but to so we sold out, and but meanwhile, McCleary, Gene McCleary, who was a very instrumental person in making this a good company, Art and I had decided that between McCleary, and this is him not, but between McCleary and Larry Jess, we had Art lovely company. That we should, out of what we sold for, we had to take cash and we had a stock because at this time their stock was down, so we took a big thing of tax on it. We should give them X amount of money, so we were the sales manager. And we passed them off to Autobahn, but we would get the gift these guys, and I thought it would get us good. And Max said no, he felt that we should have more of them. And then he said, furthermore, he said, I notice that you have a company car, and the sales manager has a company car, and I don't think this is fair, and blah, 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 blah.
Who's Max again?
Well, forget that. Mac.
Mac, okay.
So then Arthur got real irritated about that. He locked his door and said, you can't go to Mac. And so then Max started his own company, and I think he was really about to sue us for allegedly having too much of a purpose on it, if you really didn't know. And I was in a very good laws that you don't threaten people about this thing, especially if you're doing pretty well yourself. But be that as it may, Max left and started his own company, and he done a tremendous job. He's a great guy and a good guy. So anyway, we sold.
Who was Pappy?
Pate. He was working for Adams Corporation. And he decided when Mac left that he'd start his own operation.
I see. Well,
meanwhile, we have Arthur and I have no control over this once he sold it. And so he starts his own operation. He still has his mother working for Adams in domestic. This is a good play. One couldn't believe about it. And so time moves on. And Beatrice being a large, successful company, and putting in managers, once Larry Jensen got unable to handle things, they began to put in managers who knew nothing about it, several people. Triple dipping on expensive cars and all these things. I love big names. But then the time came when the price rates came. And you may recall that farm products were, there was no price rates in farm products. And so the farmers got, excuse me, but the facts of life are the farmers could raise their price of the grain and the milk and the cheese and all the rest of this, but a manufacturer using those couldn't raise the prices. And Beatrice, being a large company, couldn't afford to be dishonest about its pricing. And while they were still making money, by and large, and losing money here and there, they felt they could put their money to better use in this sort of a posture of things. Whether they're right or they're wrong, I don't know. So we elected to terminate this thing. That was my decision. Which was a very sad for me, and a lot of people don't realize I didn't know anything about it, but I had no control. I mean, the international thing at this point.
Now, was Flake Hall phased out before?
Oh, Flake Hall was phased out before that.
Before that, yeah.
We had what we call Alpha, Beta, and well, I guess it was Omega, the last Alpha, Beta, and Omega companies to phase this thing out as they took over. And the buildings at Adams Corporation were sold to the our General Electric Pension Fund in East Bank. And Flake Hall is simply, there's no need for Flake Hall. It just wasn't. So we had meanwhile moved all the Flake Hall machines up to Adams. We couldn't stand the vandalism of Flake Hall. It was just terrible. We kept breaking in and stealing things. That sent Pasha, and so I guess it was really the only question you'd like to know about.
Well, how long were you then Adams International, up until you retired?
Until I retired, yeah. Adams International had a great job.
And that's still going on?
Yeah, I operate in about 38 countries.
And that's still continuing?
Oh, yes, yeah.
It's just that you retired from it.
I retired from it. And one of the interesting things to me is that one of the many places that I established places is just in Greece. And with the CUM, and in Greece, you couldn't take the money out except you had 5% of your capital investment you could take out as a profit. And the rest of it you had to leave there. So we left the money in the First National City of New York's bank in Athens and appreciated it for 15%. And this year, now that Greece is a part of the used to be a favored nation, now it's part of the common market. And it's a gradual transition. But every year, Beatrice has an international meeting of all of its international people. The international contribution to the total of Beatrice's $9 billion sales is maybe 22%, something like that. 22% of the total sales of the nation. The international people are now, at this very moment, meaning they're having a particular trip on Greek ships and through the Greek islands using the money from Adams International down there to do this. If we say, but we hold back a lot of money. Well, we've had problems in Iran. We've seen them for a little over $5 million. But Adams International, when I retired, they moved to Miami, which is a better place for them because it's more central to work in. One of the things about Adams International that I was that it resulted in getting a foot in the door of countries and companies. One of them, Savoy, in Caracas, is the largest candy manufacturer and canned confectionery company in all of Latin America. And they came into the religious department by way of Adams International, which is the door. I can name a number of companies that this is responsible for, which I come back to Clara Matthews and your father. And I wrote to Claire today, as I said, I've been thinking of her. He wrote me a letter to this. He said, well, I think he wanted to see him.
Yeah, we went over to see him to hear his stories about the farm.
Yeah, and I've been thinking about Claire. The last letter I had from him, so he said, Alan, I'm still alive and holding. And I said, Claire, I've been thinking about you. I hope you're still holding, and we'll come back, and next time we can get together. I didn't ask if we could have dinner when we was in the hospital. But there are lots of side things. And one of these side things, they had this patent litigation in Chicago. A gentleman by the name of George I. Haight, H-A-I-G-H-T, was some remote relation to Jim Haight. Was a classmate of my father's in law school. He was a prestigious patent lawyer in Chicago. And he's the one who represented Minnesota Mining in their Scotch tape thing and the Illinois Bell telephone. He was a tremendous guy. So we're having this litigation. And I remember the first day we went in his office in Chicago, and he had his clock over a mantle there. Off the fireplace. He said, now Harry, you're my classmate, my friend. I want you and your sons Arthur and Alan to realize that I charge $1,000 an hour for consultation. Jesus, this is your good. Because he said, I have all of these clients, I have time is money. I charge $1,500 an hour in Cork. And, okay, Jerry. Well, anyway, so we're having this lawsuit in federal court. And meanwhile, father was a member of his church was, of the Union League Club of Chicago. We drove the Union League Club in between the federal court hearings, and we'd sit in the bar, and father never drank, and in those times he wouldn't permit Arthur and me to drink. And we'd have Virgin Mary's, and George I. Hate would have what he called a bee's knees. And bee's knees is a sort of honey and some sort of alcohol with a gin or like that, I don't know. But we'd sit there and he'd say, hey, how do you like this bee? And he'd go, okay, I'm 30 feet long, a naked woman with her, excuse me, girl, but with her back towards the painter. And she's, we went up here and the president of Beer City. Walked across the sea, this thing in the middle. George said, I tell you, he said, I gave this painting to the Union League Club of Chicago because I had it in my home in Evanston, where it was up here in one of our hallways. And he said, in my second life, what he could have. So I said, I gave it to the Union League Club with a suitable deduction. Oh, yeah, they're not little any guts in there.
Well, this story about Flakon, I think Jackie's got such a great...
Well, it's my own deal, isn't it?
Yeah. But and what she got was for me, that I thought that Harry and, not Harry, but Matthews and Trout...
Barry?
No.
Shrupke.
you had some litigation with Shrupke.
Shrupke became a Trojan horse.
Well, okay. Shrupke and Matthews were working on it, and they saw the need of help.
Yeah.
So they got your father and Earl Berrien.
Well, father got Earl Berrien.
Well, anyway. So
it expanded to that group.
And yeah. I thought that they weren't incorporated at that time, I don't think. But they did.
In the 30s.
But you did incorporate.
Oh, yeah.
Drake, you people had something like a quarter of the stock then?
No. Nothing then. And this is part of the problem.
Who held the stock?
Well, the Elmer Canning Company had something like 51%, I think. They had control of it. And various other people, and finally father took some stock in lieu of fees. Well, he didn't have a quarter of the stock. And that's what I'm saying. Arthur and I had to buy the controlling stock in Flakon.
Well,
we really stuck our necks out. And we went down, the Elmer Canning Company, still down to 540 Magazine Street down there, and it's a long story. But father was getting along in years, and he felt that he didn't want to take his name out, and he wanted to protect his wife, our mother, but not her to be. This thing wasn't known. With all of these cantankerous, litigious people, as a husband, you didn't want your wife to be subjected to...
No.
This sort of thing. So Art and I took it over, being young enough and stupid enough to, and fortunate enough to do it. You know?
Mm-hmm. Well,
we had nothing to lose. Matter of fact, my son Alan Jr. said when we were suing for $3.5 million, he said, Alan, he said, father, he said, I've got a couple of airplanes I put up here in wires, and you can sell them all. So
Well, as I saw the rough picture, was that the stock got, the corporation got split up pretty widely.
Yes, it did.
And there's factions.
There may have been a time, Father, I wouldn't say it didn't, but I'd say that the controlling thing was Arthur and I bought it.
But eventually the Adams got control.
But there were factions trying to take over control.
Yeah, these people who were selling themselves Colettes at less than cost wanted to keep control.
Well, I know before a meeting, I'd several times I'd have somebody come in and want to buy my stock. And it seemed to me at that time that, and then there was their times when the defeated faction couldn't get into the office, as I understand. I don't know about that.
It could be that. I don't know.
And the
there was a very unhappy group.
The company wasn't making very much money.
Making money, they were losing money.
All right. At any rate, if there was any money made, it,
and they never paid a dividend.
If there any money made, it would be just sufficient to pay the officers.
I still have the records on that.
Well, I don't care.
I don't think you do. But this is another side of the. Once again, as we all have been off and on, directing you to have hearings. So Carol called me one day. She said, "We have." Alan, she said, "You must have some files. You can give us a hearing. We need files." I said, "Well, I got files all over the place." But I said, what I have in them, I'm not sure I want to throw away. I've been thinking someday of writing a history of the company or all of these things I've observed over the years, like you have, had that experience. Very interesting times you went through. So one day I got Pro down there, my old secretary, 81 years old now, and still works for me every Saturday morning. I said, "Pro, let's go through this. This is good. Going through these files that are so basic." You know, some of the things that, forget the snack food business. This is why the Adams Corporation is called Adams Corporation Farm Girls Division. Because the facets beyond the snacks are so enormous that the snacks are just in the bottom of the pan, So I got all of these records and all of these letters from people all over the world about granulation of food and oats and mixing them all up and getting rid of this and that and something else. And your father's mentioning some of these, and I just hesitate to throw them down the drain. I don't like terrible ones. So I call Carol back.
My rule is don't throw away anything.
Well, I, this is a rule that my mother used to follow. I got that turned out. But we don't have all of the interesting things that you have. You say, my father was mayor of the town. I'd like some interesting things to say and do. But I can't. I just have a feeling of affection and dedication to these things, and I don't want to tear them up. And I'm not about to buy them a new filing case. I can give my money to the UG just like you do, And Ronald, when we were building the new Y, and you may remember I was president of the Y at the time, I said, our family's given $50,000 to the city they came for. And I said, "Ronald, you're giving up the milk business, and you're doing this and that and the other. But I know how much you and your father and your family think of the Y, and I want you to make a pledge. You made a very generous pledge. Remember that? The paint's coming off the buildings down there in the old farm. You said, we've got to give this, and I've never forgotten it. But out of the generosity of your heart, you really made a very liberal pledge to the line. Never forgotten it." And I had a couple of other nice things along the same line. Lloyd Hornbostel made a pledge and died. And his wife came over, Dorothy came over and said, I want to recognize the pledges. I understand that you have, I've seen the names, Mr. Dugan here, he's made a pledge. And all of these people, and Lloyd would feel awful if he didn't, if I didn't honor this. Another person who made the same remark was Lil Snyberg, not Lil, but Wynn Thompson's wife. Same thing that you did under different circumstances, but your fortunes as a dairy farm, as I understood at the time, were not rising. We were making other provisions for your future. And you were very generous. Remember that, Ronald?
Well, didn't they put your name up, the names of certain...
On tiles we have up there. But you have...
I didn't get my name up there because Dundura still wanted to buy, and I said, well...
Don't you tell me, I don't know. I'll tell you this, the YMCA have done again.